Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Professor David G. Schwartz, author of the book Grandissimo, The First Emperor of Las Vegas. This is a biography of Jay Sarno. We'll be talking to David in a few minutes. In the news this week, federal charges were dropped against two video poker players who somehow discovered a firmware glitch in the IGT software that would allow the players to play at dollars until they hit a four of a kind, and then get the machine to replay the exact same hands and get paid off on $10 per unit. It required the double-up feature to be turned on for this glitch to work. One player used this against several strip casinos, and at the end, most notably, the Silverton. The other player hit the Meadows Casino near Pittsburgh. The news says that the federal charges were dropped. It wouldn't surprise me, however, if there will be state charges involved as well. When the surveillance tape from the Silvertons are shown in court, it's hard for me to believe that a jury would decide these were simply players who got lucky. It wouldn't surprise me that we haven't heard the last of this case.
Do you have the charges that were dropped were actually hacking charges, right? Right, Bob?
Yeah, the hacking charges were dropped, and they tried some wire charges for a while, but those got dropped earlier. But I would think this is still going to go on.
Yeah, usually the fight is just about the money and not over, you know, criminal issues. So I'm actually kind of surprised that I would expect the criminal issues to go away, because I think it's just bad publicity for Vegas in general. I don't think the casinos want this kind of press that they're going after a player criminally for, you know, finding a glitch in their slot machine.
Yep, unless they can prove conspiracy or something like that with the with an IGT employee, something of that nature. All right. Monday of this week, the United States Supreme Court heard a case that potentially affects a large part of our audience. The specific case involves a small Indian tribe in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, which wants to build a casino on land that it owns, but is not part of the reservation. The state of Michigan doesn't want this for a variety of reasons. The argument in front of the court is whether Indian tribes are sovereign entities with respect to gaming issues, and hence have immunity from state law. The court heard arguments and is expected to rule next year sometime. The specifics pertaining to a small tribe in northern Michigan has little relevance to most of our listeners, but the bigger issue is whether or not the Indian casinos are immune from state laws. That's huge when it comes to disputes between players and Indian casinos. Richard, do you have any thoughts on this?
It is huge, and so far, basically, we've seen that players have no rights in Indian casinos. I don't understand the Indians' argument here. In the case, they mention that if France were to come buy some land in the United States, it doesn't mean they can put a casino on it because they own the land. I don't see how the argument that the Indians should be able to build a casino on land they purchase, I don't see how that has any chance of flying. But as for whether players are going to get some rights, I believe there's some other cases that are looking into this as well, and hopefully that'll get turned around, because so far players have not done well trying to fight Indian casinos.
Very good. Let's talk to our guest. Professor David G. Schwartz, the director of the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. In addition, he's a writer, speaker, and consultant. His PhD is in history, and most of his writings are related to the history of gambling. He's here tonight to speak about his newest book, Grandissimo, The First Emperor of Las Vegas, which is about the rise and fall of Las Vegas icon Jay Sarno. David Schwartz, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me, Bob, and you too, Richard.
For the first 10 minutes or so of the interview, why don't you summarize who Jay Sarno was and why he's important to the history of Las Vegas?
Sure, I can definitely do that. Jay was a guy who came out of Atlanta. He was originally born in St. Joe, Missouri, came to Atlanta, was developing hotels and motels there, and came to Las Vegas first in February of 1963 on a junket at the Flamingo, and absolutely hated it. Now, the thing about Jay was he was a habitual gambler. He, from an early age, he was just always wanting to gamble, always gambling, really, really a, as he would call it, as he called himself, a gambling degenerate. So, loved to gamble. So you might wonder, well, why did he hate Las Vegas? Because this is one of the only places in the country you could do this legally at the time. Shouldn't he have loved it? Shouldn't he have thought, well, this is the best thing ever? And he did not like the fact that everything there was so plain. There wasn't really a lot of romance. There wasn't a lot of mystery. There wasn't a lot of fantasy involved. It was pretty much you pull up, you park in front of the casino, you buy in, you gamble. You get your steak, which you're not going to pay a lot for, but it doesn't taste that great. You see a show, maybe you meet a girl, but it's really kind of very basic stuff, not very exciting. He had the idea that you could take that and put a spin on it, give it that little twist, and it would be something that people would really like. So he comes out here, like a lot of gamblers, doesn't like the results for what he has, and instead of just saying, well, the house always wins, this place isn't any good, says, no, I'm going to do better. Which to me is his real genius. The fact that he, throughout his life, he was in a lot of situations and circumstances where the odds were against him, but he always said, well, no, I can do better. I can really excel at this. So to me, that's him in a nutshell. So he comes here and gets a loan from the Teamsters and gets some money from some other places and starts building Caesar's Palace. By the time it opens in 1966, there's a lot of anticipation because people have been talking about this. A lot of the big gamblers in the East Coast are really looking forward to it because this is supposed to be the most spectacular casino ever. And he manages to pull it off. You know, he does pull it off. So that's really his origin and how he came to Las Vegas.
Very good. You said he got financing from the Teamsters for both Caesar's Palace and later for Circus Circus. Now, the Teamsters Union is about truck drivers.
Mm-hmm.
Were they considered to be part of organized crime?
Well, it was definitely influenced by organized crime, and there was some organized crime involved in some of the locals that was later proven in federal court cases, and there's definitely that organized crime influence. The interesting thing, though, is the way that Jay got in touch with Jimmy Hoffa in the first place, which is one of the things I talk about in the book, which I've never seen anybody else talk about. And it really makes, it kind of puts everything in perspective, how they first got in touch.
Uh-huh.
And the other really interesting thing is that they became very good friends. And to hear Bobby Kennedy talk about it,
He was attorney general at the time.
Yeah, to hear Bobby Kennedy talk about it, Jimmy Hoffa was evil incarnate, was this terrible, awful person, you know, with no redeeming qualities. But talking to some of Jay Sarno's kids, you know, this was Uncle Jimmy. And, you know, this was a guy who they grew up knowing. And it really puts a different spin on the whole thing. So they actually became very good friends. I think they both respected each other. They're very different. Hoffa was not into the party life like Jay was. Hoffa was all about his union and making life better for his truck drivers and becoming powerful in his union, whereas Jay really was just looking for the next party, for the next big thing to gamble on. But they had a lot in common. I think they grew to like each other.
You know, my impression was that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it just seemed to me that Sarno was incredibly lucky in the right place at the right time in two instances. The first was when he started building these hotels. Apparently the government after the war was just giving money away to people to try to get them to build stuff. And he saw an opportunity and took it and started building his hotel chain. And then he got this opportunity where he finds Hoffa, and Hoffa basically loans him just ridiculous amounts of money. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. And the thing about Jay is that he really made his own luck a lot of times. And this is just, you know, it's in everything he did. So, for example, he would see a pretty girl that he liked, and he would go up to her and proposition her, and he would get slapped on the face 9 times, but the 10th time it would work. And so he just kept on. He's just a very tenacious guy. You know, he just wouldn't take no for an answer. So if he hadn't have hooked up with Jimmy Hoffa, he eventually probably would have hooked up with somebody else. So I think that's another thing about him. He was so tenacious, and he just refused to give in. Again, it's that gambling mentality where the odds are against you, but you know that you're going to be the one who beats the house. So that's really him in a nutshell. And yeah, he did get very lucky a couple times.
He
was not a very likable guy to me. I mean, it was hard reading the book. It was hard to like the guy for me. You know, he was a degenerate and a womanizer. I mean, he was cheating on not only his wife and his mistress.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Did you find him likable writing about him?
He was tough to write about, you know. But again, this isn't really a business run by the Boy Scouts, so I guess I better get used to it. But I went through a lot of different stages. At first, I was intrigued, saying, well, here's this visionary who built these casinos. And then you learn more and say, you know, he did have a lot of very unsavory things in his life. But I think then you get past that judgment and you realize, well, what does his life have to tell all of us? And I think that's interesting. I've heard from a lot of people who say that, well, like, oh, at first I didn't like him, but you made him sympathetic. And I was rooting for him, and I was hoping he was going to turn it around. And it's very interesting. You know, I think for me, this was a flawed man, but also in a lot of ways a great man, in the sense that a lot of people in history are, you know, and a lot of the people we look at in history as great people also were very flawed. And I think his flaws and the fact that he was so successful in Las Vegas can tell us a lot about ourselves and how we approach Las Vegas.
The second casino that he was majorly involved in is Circus, which today does not have the charisma of Caesar's Palace, but it is still a major casino. Now, it opened up without a hotel. It had significant problems, but it eventually worked.
Yeah.
So, how was he involved in that?
Okay, so imagine that you're Jay Sarno. So you build Caesar's Palace. Now, they got about half the money from the Teamsters. The other half, they went around basically borrowing money from everybody in the East Coast, all the big gamblers. And some of this money had some strings attached. So some of the money came with the condition that they would put certain people into the casino to run it. And these were Miami bookmakers, pretty tough guys who were, you know, allegedly hooked up with the mob there, and not the kind of guys you could boss around. And the problem was that Jay wanted to be in charge of the casino. Nate Jacobson, who was an insurance guy from Baltimore who got a lot of the money, also wanted to be in charge of the casino. And the guys who were connected thought they were in charge. So after butting heads with them for about a year, Jay pretty much said, you know, this isn't going to work out. And he started trying to sell the casino. And again, this is where you look at his personality coming through. So imagine that you're a hotel developer from Atlanta and you've got a good life there. You play golf at the country club. You've got a great family. You get bitten by this bug. You move to Las Vegas and you build a casino and you find out that there's alleged mobsters muscling in the place and running the place and maybe skimming money. Okay. Most sensible people then say, you know what? This didn't work out. I'm in over my head. I'm going to move back to Atlanta. I'm going to call Jimmy and say, Jimmy, can you give me a loan? I want to start a laundry business or a pencil store or something like that.
Jimmy might have been in jail at this point.
Yeah, but Alan Dorfman was still out. So it's not inconceivable that he could have gone back to Atlanta and gotten, he would have been okay. You know, with the friendships he made with Jimmy Hoffa and then Alan Dorfman, he would not have needed ass twice. So most sensible people would have said, well, I'm going to get out of this. I'm going to get out of this business. It's not doing it for me. Jay, though, says, you know what? Screw this. I didn't do it right this time. I'm going to do it right next time. I'm doubling down. I'm going to build another casino. So I'm going to get out of this one. I'm going to build another one. that, to me, that's what makes him such an exceptional person. And the ironic thing that we know now is, so he's got these Miami bookmakers in there. Again, these are rough guys. One of them went to jail for allegedly fixing the, I think, 1948 NFL championship game, or trying to. So tough guys. Build Circus Circus. Within a couple years, you've got a guy named Tony Spilotro, who's supposedly managing the gift shop, but he's really watching the skim in the count room. So you go from these Miami bookmakers to probably the most feared guy in the history of the Chicago outfit. So out of the frying pan into the fire, that was Jay. You know, always trying to get the edge, but sometimes the edge getting the better of him.
You know, I don't think people realize what a really crazy place Circus Circus was when it opened. Why don't we talk about some of the things that Circus Circus was doing or that Jay wanted to do when it first opened?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty crazy. And people have seen the movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, read the Hunter S. Thompson book, you know, seen that movie with Johnny Depp in it. And there's a scene where Johnny Depp goes into this casino that's obviously modeled very closely in Circus Circus, and it's very psychedelic, and he's under the influence of a lot of drugs. And I will say this. The actual casino is crazier than anything that Hunter S. Thompson came up with. You know, it was actually crazier than that. And there's a part in the book where I have Jay narrating what's going on in the casino. So he's saying, well, you walk in and you see a girl changing into a gorilla, and then you see a guy jumping 60 feet into a sponge. Then a Highland marching band comes by. Then you see these acrobats. And, you know, here we have the place where you can get everything you want to eat for $1.50. And then here we've got a store where you give your money to the monkey, and the monkey will get you the merchandise. And then we've got a monkey, and when you win, he jumps up and down. And when you lose, he cries for you. It was just insane stuff that nobody could believe. So, I mean, it was absolutely wild.
And one of his ideas was to have topless shoeshine girls?
Yeah. And, you know, again, this was a guy who didn't... I think the other thing about Jay is that he was a guy who didn't believe in boundaries. So he had children, and he liked to see his children having fun with the bumper cars and things like that. So he's like, all right, well, we'll have this midway, and we'll have the kid stuff, but then we'll also have the nudie shows and stuff like that. And one of the ideas he wanted to do was to have half topless shoeshine girls. Because think, well, what guy wouldn't like having a shoe shined and the girl's not wearing a shirt? Gaming Commission said no. So the Gaming Commission kind of reeled him back into that one. But it just shows the way he thought that everything was revolving around pleasure and breaking rules and having absolutely no boundaries.
Yeah, I had a friend who was a dealer at Circus when it opened. And when it first opened, there was no roof over the casino, mm-hmm. So the circus acts were going on literally over your head. But he, one of the stories he told me was they had this baby elephant that they would bring down into the casino, and they had trained the elephant to throw dice. And but the dealers and bosses loved to do this, apparently, because when the elephant would throw the dice, he would blow snot all over the people on the table. And the dealers and bosses apparently found that quite amusing.
Yeah, you know, and he had so many ideas about what to do and things like that, that on paper seems like a good idea, but he would, at least he would try it. And he said during his trial, which we'll get to, he said a line that struck me as great. I had this idea at Circus Circus. It wasn't such a good idea, but, you know, there's no bad ideas when you think of them. You have to try them first, then you find out if they're good or bad. So I think that was him. You know, definitely Tawny the elephant was probably more trouble than she was worth, but it was something he really, really believed in.
Well, another idea that he tried, you talk about in the book, that didn't work, was he charged people to get into the casino, right, when
yeah.
it first opened?
Yeah, and he did this, he did this because the circus acts were free, and he didn't want everybody bringing their families and just watching the circus acts and not gambling, so he figured charging admission would ameliorate that. You know, he did run into a lot of problems. Nobody was used to it. The cab drivers got really mad because they would get tipped in... they would get paid in chips, and they would come to redeem the chips, and they would try to charge them $2 to get in. And at one point, one of the more absurd scenes in the book for me is there's this near riot of cab drivers in front of Circus Circus. So, you've got Jay Sarno trying to conciliate this average angry mob of cab drivers. So it's just incredible, trying to do the right thing, how many people he was able to get upset at sometimes.
My friend who was dealing there at the time, and you go into this in the book, there was a massive skimming operation going on where they would fly these junkets in from New York and maybe Philly and somewhere else. And basically, there were a whole group of dealers and bosses whose, you know, job was to dump off money to these agents who would fly in on these junkets. And apparently Jay didn't know this was going on, but they were basically just, you know, taking off all the money they could. Now, and you talk about that in the book, but eventually they were caught, or there was something happened that eventually stopped that?
Yeah, eventually Bill Bennett takes control of the casino and manages to get them out. I'm still not sure exactly how he did it, if he just paid them off or what, you know, how they did that. But it is an interesting question. There's obviously skimming going on there. Later on, when Carl Thomas testified at his trial, he testified that it was happening. So it's obviously happening, you know. To the extent that Jay know about it, that's something I'd speculate about. A lot of times he said stuff like, well, we're not making money, so you can't skim because we're not making money. And I did read the transcripts of some of the wiretaps where he was talking and didn't know that he was being recorded. And he seems to indicate there that he didn't know that there was any problem with that. And he just thought it was bad luck and people not coming in. So it's very interesting. He's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place there.
You mentioned a trial. He tried to bribe an IRS agent or something of that nature.
Yes.
And how did that work out?
Well, this is interesting. So he's got a couple of tax cases going on. He's got appeals. He believes that he's owed money back, about $500,000 in total. And he is trying to get this money. He was trying to get this money for years. And here's where there's a difference of opinion. According to him, an IRS agent approached him and said, I know you've got this appeal, it's going to be denied, and furthermore, we're going to bring a criminal complaint against you. Now, the backstory of this is that ever since about 1958-59, when the Atlanta Cabana opened, which was Teamster financed, Jay had been in the crosshairs of the IRS. They'd gone through his records every year. When Circus opened, they pretty much set up shop. They actually took one of the conference rooms in their executive offices and set up a branch office of the IRS in there to save them the trouble of bringing down all of the receipts and things like that. And they were looking at receipts for everything, you know, things that cost $10 they were demanding receipts for. So they were just subjecting him to this incredible scrutiny for about 5 years, and they had nothing to show for it. Okay, now, according to the prosecutors, Jay at this point approached this agent and solicited him and said, I'm going to pay you a bribe to get my refund and to get you guys off my back. And the agent said yes. According to Jay, he was actually entrapped, where the agent said, look, if you don't give me this money, I'm going to make sure this goes against you. I've been here for 18 years. I can make anything stick. So that's the difference of opinion. The great thing at the trial is that Jay was represented by a young attorney named Oscar Goodman.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. And Oscar had a couple of big cases, some of them involving some of the bookmaker friends of Jay from Caesars. So Oscar had some big cases, but this was a pretty big one because you had the federal government coming into Las Vegas in the years right after Watergate, basically saying that Jay and his partner, Stan Malin, had bribed this agent. So it was really the feds versus Las Vegas. So Oscar's got this problem that they had wiretaps of Jay doing all kinds of crazy things. First of all, of Jay giving this agent the money, which they proved that Jay gave the money. Second of all, of Jay doing things like threatening the agent, telling the agent how to launder money. It doesn't look good. Okay, so he doesn't look good at all. What happens is they're able to introduce enough reasonable doubt in the jury's mind that Jay was entrapped, that it's not such an open and shut case. Basically, they didn't have the first conversation was not recorded because they met in the steam room at Circus Circus, which is a fascinating meeting there. And they were able to really raise the question of was Sarno entrapped? And it also plays into the real us versus them attitude that had been going on in Vegas for a while there since the Kennedy administration, when they'd stepped up a lot of the wiretaps and stuff like that against the casino owners. There'd been sentiment about that. And also since Watergate, there a lot of people were fearful of the federal government. So this was kind of the Oscar and Harry Claiborne, who was the other counsel, were able to really take these fears and put them in front of the jury.
You know, I got the impression in reading it that he was entrapped, but you wrote it. I mean, was your gut feeling that he was entrapped, or do you think they just spun it that way?
There's a couple of things. You know, I was skeptical at first, but there's a couple of things. You know, first of all, this guy, the IRS undercover agent had been there for months and had never heard from Sarno until they had a third party tell Sarno, you've got to call this guy. So it was I was kind of skeptical from that. Also, he had a lot of lawyers and accountants, and he had a lot of people working in this case. And they, you know, basically he had been trying to do this legitimately. Another thing, it later came out that there was it's kind of funny, you know, we've all heard the phrase, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that everybody's not out to get you. You know, he really was the target of this government vendetta. It later came out that when Frank Fitzsimmons became president of the Teamsters, he made a deal with the Nixon administration, basically saying that in return for us giving Nixon support in his 1972 reelection, we're going to give you our enemies list and you target these people. Since Sarno was a Hoffa loyalist, he was on that list. So a lot of the stuff makes sense that maybe he was the target of this vendetta. It makes a lot of sense.
Circus.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bob.
I was going to change subjects. And because the third casino that Sarno wanted to build was going to be called Grandissimo.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be on Industrial, now called Dean Martin, mm-hmm. approximately behind where the Mirage is now. Now, it was going to be very much like perhaps the current Wynn or the current Bellagio or the current Spectacular Casino. Now, Sarno died in 1984 before it could be built. Late in his life, Sarno was something of a persona non grata to the various gaming regulators and the federal government due to, among other things, his former ties to organized crime. Had Sarno lived, say, 10 years longer, do you think his casino would have been actually completed and opened?
I think it might have been. You know, if you look at it, he really started seriously trying to get this built in 1979. And his problem was that, unlike Steve Wynn, who could talk to Wall Street and had Michael Milken to get the junk bonds to build Golden Nugget in Atlantic City and then later Mirage, Jay couldn't really speak that language. And he didn't yet have anyone around him that could speak that language. You know, now it's possible that if he had lived and had found somebody like that, he would have been in the same position as Bill Bennett at Circus Circus. So in 1983, Circus Circus buys out Jay Sarno. He's no longer there. He had been originally their landlord. They buy him out in 83, and they go public. And they hire a young man named Glenn Schaefer, who becomes a CFO, who basically speaks the language of Wall Street and takes Bennett and Pennington's ideas and puts them into language that the Wall Street guys can understand. They get a lot of money. And by the end of the 80s, they're the most successful casino company in the world because of that. So it's not inconceivable that Jay could have gotten his own Glenn Schaefer. His daughter, September, had been going to business school, and it's possible that she would have stepped into that role. So it's possible that if he could have found that person to talk to the Wall Street people, you know, you've got his creative genius. If you get a finance person and then an operations person, you know, I think he could have gotten it built.
And it makes it pretty clear in the book that he was really a huge influence on Steve Wynn, right?
Yeah, it's interesting too. You know, Wynn talked about how many times he talked to him. They had these long conversations about casino design. One of the most telling things is when I interviewed Steve Wynn, he told me about the time that he showed Jay his plans for the Hotel of the Golden Nugget in Las Vegas, and Jay kind of looked at him, then looked at him and kind of nodded and said, yeah, you know, I think you're getting it. And that really meant a lot to him. You know, 30 years later, 35 years later, he's remembering this conversation. And, you know, he saw that as the torch being passed and going from a you know, before that, it seems like it was a mentor-student relationship in some ways. You know, the experienced guy telling the kid how the business goes to really being peers. And, you know, I really found that shift in the relationship.
You know, we kind of jumped ahead, but we didn't really talk about the opening of Caesars. One of the things I found interesting was Caesars was not ready to open on the day that it opened, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole thing was a nightmare. There were so many things going wrong when that opened that never should have had a successful opening, you know. For one, you had this big national airline strike, so they had to get a charter jet to basically, you know, it was the most incredible thing, you know, picking up all of these huge gamblers in New York and Baltimore. You know, basically every big gambler in the East Coast is coming to this. So, I mean, just imagine the stories that must have been going back and forth in that plane as they're drinking and flying out to Vegas for this opening. The construction had been running behind. The furniture wasn't in the rooms. You know, while people are going up to the rooms, they're bringing their furniture in with them to the rooms. It was just really wild. You know, they barely got it open. And part of that was because they were so, you know, so underfunded. It was so hard to get that money, which is one of the reasons why within, you know, the next year after Caesars opened, they passed the first of the corporate gaming acts to open up the industry to the big corporations, because it became clear that these things are becoming more expensive and the old networks of the wise guys can't get that kind of money.
Yeah, I one of the things I thought was interesting was that back then they used to pack the furniture in literal popcorn, real popcorn.
Yeah.
So these boxes of furniture and lamps and everything out in the parking lot, the guys are basically eating the popcorn as they're moving the furniture into the hotel.
Yeah, and to me, this is another moment that kind of showed Jay's personality in maybe a little bit of a more subtle way. You know, you've got a guy, you know, he's borrowed all this money, borrowed $19 million. The thing is not ready to open. It looks like it's going terribly. And he's just so calm. He's walking around the popcorn, walking around the parking lot eating popcorn. It's like, yeah, you know, well, maybe it opens, maybe it doesn't. This is the thrill of it. You know, there's another incident like that later on, too, that Oscar Goodman told me about, where as they're waiting for the verdict in this trial to come back, and you've got to understand that because Jay feared going to prison so much, he had had health problems and just knew that he couldn't get along with people in prison, he viewed going to prison as a death sentence. So he said, if I'm convicted, they might as well, you know, put a needle in me because I'm a dead man if I get convicted. So they're waiting for the verdict to come back. And he says, well, you know, Oscar, this is kind of boring. Let's go down to the Las Vegas Country Club and we'll play 18 holes. I'll bet you're not going to beat me in any of them. And Oscar's thinking to himself, well, huh, this guy's under a lot of stress. You know, I'll beat him in one of them for sure. And Jay won all of them, you know, beat him every time. And as Oscar said, backbone of steel. And you know, coming from a man like Oscar Goodman, who's represented his fair share of rough customers and, you know, has seen these guys under the worst possible kind of stress and duress, for him to place Jay in that category says a lot to me.
You know, one of the things that I'm happy about was that I got to eat in the original Bacchanal room at Caesars before it was taken out. But why don't you talk about what the original Bacchanal was like, and also about his idea with the piranhas.
Yeah, and that's one of the funnier ideas. So originally the concept was you're going to have this ultra, ultra gourmet restaurant. You're not going to just have people coming and taking your order and bringing you the drinks. You're going to have wine goddesses. So they're not just waitresses, they're wine goddesses. They peel the grapes and put them in your mouth. They massage your temples. And again, this was Jay as, you know, everything is around gratifying himself and gratifying other men. It was all about that. You know, you're the Caesar, you're the center of attention. And, you know, I'm sure some people were a little bit freaked out by that at first, but apparently it was a pretty compelling thing. For the executive chef, he hired Nat Hart, who had one of the most distinguished careers out of any Las Vegas F&B people, so very well-known guy. So he had the right person running it, and this was just a phenomenal restaurant. The thing about Jay, though, is that having it right is never enough. And so you've got a great concept with the wine goddesses. You've got Nat Hart making sure the food is phenomenal. You've got a great menu, giving them all the money they need. It needs something else. And he'd read that they used to have sacrifices to gods before Roman feasts. So the idea was, you're going to have a seating for dinner. When everybody's seated, you're going to have the guys in the gladiator outfits come out carrying a live piglet, above them in the litter. And they're going to throw that pig into a pool filled with piranhas. And the piranhas are going to strip the flesh from this thing, and this will be the sacrifice. Which is absolutely, just absolutely...
It's horrifying.
It's a horrifying thought. To just imagine the thought of watching a living being be consumed by other animals alive. I don't know if I could sleep for a week, let alone sit down to a gourmet meal. But he thought, well, no, this is a spectacle and people will want this. And luckily they talked him out of that one.
If our listeners want a copy of Grandissimo, how do they get it?
Oh, there's a lot of places they can go for a copy. First, I would check grandissimobook.com. That has links to every place you can buy it online. Some of the places you can get a paperback book include Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the Gambler's Book Club, and other places you can find online. The ebook is available in Kindle, Nook, Kobo, and iBooks format, so it's available in all those, and you can get all those links from grandissimobook.com. If you're in Las Vegas and want to buy a copy while you're in Las Vegas, there are copies for sale at the Gambler's Book Club, which is on Eastern. And there are also copies for sale at the Mob Museum. So there are plenty of places to get the book. And if you'd like it in your local bookstore, contact them. Go to grandissimobook.com. I've got the ISBN and all the ordering information there. They can order copies there, too.
This isn't your first book. What other books have you written about the history of gambling that might appeal to players?
Yeah, my first book was Suburban Xanadu, which looked at the evolution of the Strip. It's... more of an academic book, and it's definitely an academic price. I think it's about $50 for a paperback. So as great as that book is, until they bring it out in a lower price paperback, I can't really say, this is one to rush out and get. Also wrote a book about internet gaming and the Wire Act called Cutting the Wire, where I look at a lot of that stuff. That's good. Probably the most prominent one is Roll the Bones, A History of Gambling, which is out in a new casino edition. It focuses basically on the evolution of casinos from their origins up to today.
Good. And when he came into the studio today, he brandished two copies of Roll the Bones. So Munch and I can each get a copy. And it's a good chance you folks are going to be hearing from Mr. Schwartz again in, I don't know, February, March or so. Munch is a slow reader.
We did have a listener question that I thought I would throw to you. So somebody wrote in to ask, have you thought of writing a historic guidebook to Las Vegas where you suggest places to go and see things and then explain the history of those particular places? Maybe here's where Frank Rosenthal's car blew up.
Yeah. Like yeah. I actually had been thinking about that and thought, well, maybe it's a little self-indulgent. Nobody's going to want to read this historical stuff that I find fascinating. People might not want to read it.
I actually thought this was a great idea when I saw the question.
Yeah. And I think that might be my next project. I'm looking at a couple of different options right now, but that certainly seems like a good, I think there's a market for it. The tough thing about guidebooks is they're always changing, but I think if you key it more in the history, you can get around that. Great idea, though. Great question, and yeah, I'm seriously considering that.
Although a lot of the places are sort of built over, so you can't get to them.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this, so you can talk about the Rat Pack and all that stuff at the Sands, and then say, well, it's covered over by the Venetian now, but I think there's still enough of the historic stuff, especially when you get into downtown, that you could hopefully, get a nice little guidebook out of that.
Very good. Thank you, David G. Schwartz. We got some more questions for Dr. Schwartz than we're going to do after our commercials. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. Between December 15th and 30, you get 50% off on most everything while using your points, including restaurants, liquor stores, showrooms, spa, movies, etc. They've done this in the past several years in December, which is a good reason not to cash out all your points earlier. The 50% off is even good at New Year's Eve party. If you want to join Bonnie and me, we're going to be at the Tony Orlando concert, but the attraction to us is the excellent piano player Wes Winters, and a big dance floor is going to be preceding the Tony Orlando concert. I didn't take the name Bob Dancer because I like to sing. The Monday through Saturday, December 16 to 21, players who play $1,000 coin in at video poker or $400 coin in at slots earn an electric knife with carving fork. That will be picked up Sunday through Tuesday just before Christmas. Double point day in December will be Christmas Day, December 25th, midnight to midnight, no limits. If you're looking for me, check out the Quick Quads machine during graveyard. There's been no official word yet, but I'm very much expecting New Year's Day will also be double points. At the Palms, the $62,000 Greedy Grinch drawing consists of five winners each Friday and Saturday evening at 8 p.m., each of whom will grab a 1 in 10 money bags, where the top prize on the board will be $4,000. Points are earned by playing the machines since the preceding Saturday at 8 p.m. On Friday and Saturday evenings, you receive five times drawing tickets from 8 p.m. until midnight. For the play, earn, and win Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from now until December 23rd, they have gift cards, primarily Visa gift cards. You can earn up to $200 a day of each of these Monday, Wednesday, Friday days in the Visa gift cards. And there's some $5 cards for a few different outlets. The rate is 0.22% for video poker and 2.9% for slots. Those of you who can recognize slot progressives, this is an excellent value for the for that, because it's now an over 3% slot club on top of a game that you already have the advantage. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw Frenzy, Hyper Bonus, etc. Often these games are the best returning games in a casino, and you need practice to make sure you know how to play. While the website is free to use, gold memberships avoid the pop-up ads, and you're allowed to change pay schedules on the games. And in some cases, you get right-wrong correction with respect to whether or not you've made the correct play. Correction for some of these games is available in no other commercially available software. Next week, we're having an interview with Tommy Hyland and John Chang. Tommy Hyland has been managed a blackjack team for more than 30 years. John Chang was the head of the MIT blackjack team for about 10 years. The subject, of course, is running a blackjack team. And we actually taped this a while ago because I'm going to be out of town next week. I thought the show came out really well. What did you think, Munch?
Yeah, I thought it came out really well, too, and I like this idea of having more than one guest to talk about a specific subject. So, you know, maybe we'll come up with some more ideas like this in the future and you know, go with this sort of panel discussion idea.
Yeah, good. And in 2 weeks, we're going to have an accountant on who's also a player, and he'll be talking about things we need to think about before the end of the year, tax-wise. And in 3 weeks, I know it's way ahead, but there's a title of a talk that is so good that we have to mention it. Brian McAllister, who's been on the show as a video poker player, he's also an option trader during the day, and he's going to be talking about how doing the options market is very much like casinos. And he calls his talk Gambling with a Hedge. So when he told us that, we had to have him on the show. That's just end of story. All right. We now have some more questions for Professor David D. Schwartz. The Mob Museum and you, how do they go together?
They go together very, very well. The book is on sale at the Mob Museum gift shop all the time. Also, on December 13th and 14th, I'll be down there. And the 13th, I think I'm there from around 1 to 5, give or take, in the gift shop, answering questions, hopefully signing books that people are buying. And on the 14th, I'm giving a talk in the historic courtroom there, which for me is a real thrill. you know, to think that this is where so much of the history was made and all the stuff that's happened there. And I'm giving a talk in there. So it's going to be very exciting. So that's on the 14th. I'm giving a talk. Books will be available then as well. It's a great, great event. It is free if you're a member. Just come on down. If you're not a member, you have to pay admission to the museum. So I suggest making a day out of it. There's a good 3 hours of entertainment in the museum if you pay the admission and go in. So I think it's a pretty good value play. You're gonna get your money's worth going through that museum, and then the talk is really a nice bonus.
What are trippies?
Oh, great question. The trippies are awards that are given annually by VegasTripping.com, and they've gotten a lot of run. If you go to the D, you'll see that the D advertises on some of their LEDs and in their signage. They advertise their trippy awards and their nominations. So that's very neat. Also Planet Hollywood has as well in the past. So trippies are awards that are voted on by people who go to the site VegasTripping.com. So they're just people who like Vegas and gambling. And they have several sections in the trippies. So you can have best casino, best video poker, best blackjack, best casino carpets, one of them, best show. And they also have some categories that Grandissimo is eligible for. And Grandissimo has been nominated in. And one of them is the best new thing. And the book is up against, I think, Link and Slotzilla, neither of which have opened yet. So I think it's got the clear edge there. And I think also Downtown Grand. And my comment about Downtown Grand is that when you buy your copy of Grandissimo, I can guarantee it's never going to change pay tables on you. Ah. Unlike Downtown Grand. So I'm thinking,
the competition.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that that might influence your vote there. Another thing, it's up for best news, and I think Britney Spears is one of the people I'm up against. I hope that goes. And there's a lot of categories to look at, so I definitely encourage your listeners to go and check it out and cast your votes, and you may find a couple other things to vote for as well.
Are you connected with that site, David?
I am part of the Vegas Gang, which is a podcast that Chuck from Vegas Tripping takes part in. So yeah, kind of tangentially I am. So we're part of the Vegas Gang, which is a Vegas podcast that focuses not so much on the gambling aspects, more on the casino design and what's going on and that sort of news. So yeah.
Tell us more about these podcasts. Are they available to our listeners?
Yeah, if they go to VegasGangPodcast.com, they can get them. And we're always encouraging people to listen. We have a mix of us talking about the big news with what's going on in the casino design and the Vegas world. We also have guests on. So it's very exciting. And it's a good chance for me to get to really discuss some of the issues in depth that I like to talk about as well. So it's a great podcast. Definitely suggest you listen in addition to this one, of course.
Of course.
We have a few minutes left, right, Bob?
Yes, we have about 6 minutes left.
I'd like to talk about Sarno's degenerate gambling, because when I first moved to Las Vegas, I went into the backgammon club, and I got to meet Puggy Pearson, and I heard that he had won $200,000 that week playing golf with Jay Sarno, and this was 1977. So that was just an enormous amount of money. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, there's a group of guys at the Las Vegas Country Club who Sarno really should have been put him down as dependents on his tax forms, because basically these guys made their livings off of him for about 10 or 15 years. You know, he knew he wouldn't gamble unless it was high stakes. And these were the only guys who had that kind of action in town. And he knew they were cheating him, but it didn't matter because he needed the action. He absolutely needed it. And he figured, well, maybe I'm a good enough golfer, because he actually was an excellent golfer. You know, I'm a good enough golfer that I can get around them. And Evel Knievel, who I interviewed for the book just before he died, had some really good stories about stuff that happened with some of the folks down at the country club and him getting cheated. But, you know, they basically would cheat him in anything. You know, he was also a very good gin rummy player. And when he played, because he wore these thick glasses, because of the diabetes and his eyesight was getting worse, they were actually able to see his cards reflected in the glasses. So, I mean, he was just getting abused by these guys everywhere. And, you know, without a doubt, over the years, millions of dollars that got transferred from Jay to them.
You know, I want to add that one of the guys who was taking that money from Sarno wrote a book called Ace Deuce. The guy's name is John Anderson. So he of course doesn't cop to the fact that he was cheating him, but it's a rather interesting book as well.
Yeah, and you know I don't expect any of the guys who were involved to say yeah we cheated him, but talking to everybody who was around, it was pretty clear, and you know he knew it, and he's saying there was one case which is one of my favorite stories in the book. So they're on the golf course. Jay's got Evil as his partner. The guys are still trying funny stuff. So Evil pulls out his gun and threatens to shoot him. Somebody calls the police. Ralph Lamb shows up.
The sheriff
Ralph Lamb, who's legendary in Las Vegas, and says, "Look, boys, let's calm this down. You know these guys are cheats. Why are you playing with them?" And Jay said, "Well, it's the only game in town. I can't get this action from anyone else." And he's like, "Well, then you gotta tolerate it and put the gun away." So it's, yeah. I mean, it was just complete degeneracy, and he just didn't care.
That's the way Vegas used to be.
Yeah,
good old days.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, you are, among other things, the director of the Center for Gaming Research at UNLV. And recently you gave a talk about investing in table game players. We have a lot of table game players listening to the show. So generally, what was your point of view in that talk about investing?
It was a couple of things. It was looking at the trends for casino revenues. And you can see over the past 2 years or so, slots are weakening all across the country. They're not doing as great as they were. Tables are picking up steam. And, you know, in the talk, I broke down the specific markets and how big they were, you know, how big it was in different markets. So in some places, like in Reno, maybe they're only 15 or 20%. On the Strip, they're about 50%, so a lot bigger in the Strip. But everywhere, it looks like tables are gaining ground. I think the reason for this is that people can get that same slot product or experience pretty much anywhere. In a couple years, you'll be doing it on your phone. And it's the same thing. You know, you don't need to be there to play the slot machine, but you do need to be there to play the table game and have that thrill. Online poker to me is a totally different game. It has almost nothing to do with playing craps or baccarat in a casino. So because of that, my advice to the casino managers was you need to look at what you're doing. You need to invest more in your table games players. Try to get more people to play table games while they're still in your casino, because in 5 or 10 years, if they just want to play video poker or slots, they're not going to need to be in your casino to do that. So that was my advice to them.
Am I right that although table game revenues are rising, the game of blackjack is falling?
Blackjack, it all depends on the jurisdiction, but in Nevada especially, blackjack has declined quite a bit from its heights. One of the reasons is the rise of baccarat, which is that huge game for high rollers. The other reason is a rise of a lot of the other games, a lot of the carnival games and things like that that people are playing. So there's a lot of opportunities for people who want to invent new games, because those are also becoming more popular.
Now, the New Jersey online gaming, which just opened up really recently, you can play baccarat online. You can play blackjack online. So it doesn't have the social aspect with other players at the table, but it is very much the same game.
Yeah, but for me, the social aspect is so much of it. And if you go into, look in the high limit rooms in any casino and see what's going on there with all the kind of ceremony around the game, it's clear that these guys just aren't there to make money, to try to win money. They want something else. And this is what I told the table games managers too. I said, look, if your players just wanted to make money, they would just go, if they just wanted money, they would just go buy lottery tickets or something. They're not coming to you for money. I mean, they do want to win. They definitely want to win, but they're coming for you for something else, for that experience of being at the table game and playing that game. So you got to make them happy and decide what will keep them coming to you, because there's plenty of other places people can gamble. Lots of other places.
Very good. We've been talking to David G. Schwartz, author of the book Grandissimo, The First Emperor of Las Vegas. Thank you, David. Thank you, Munchkin. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.